Good morning, and the conversation begins here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon, and what a week it's been. Election Day 2018 passed into history. Mixed results, whatever you think, we're the ones who voted for it, for good, for bad, or somewhere in between. Also, we have to remember to send our thoughts and prayers and love to the people of Thousand Oaks, California. Such tragedy. Gun control, it seems to me anyway, needs some help. And when we come back in just a bit, we're going to talk about networking. That's an overused term, or is it? How do you do it? Do you do it in person? Do you do it over the internet? Or something of both? All this and more when we come back in just a bit. It's 94WIP Conversation. My name's Peter Solomon. And we're back, and it's a cold WIP morning here on 94WIP Conversation. Always hot conversation here on 94WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. I'm pleased to welcome here a gentleman who's been a guest before, but always has a lot to say. His name is Stephen David Elliott, and he's going to talk to us about networking, in particular networking face-to-face in the age of digital. Good morning, Stephen Elliott.
Good morning, Peter. So happy to be back on the show with you.
Happy to have you back. Networking implies face-to-face, but digital implies face-to-computer. How do you do both?
Well, let's say this. With digital, I think digital is a tool. You're not face-to-face. You're not physically in front of someone, but you are utilizing digital to leverage your face-to-face. But that being said, if you don't do the physical and you don't do the face-to-face, you're doing it at your own peril. You're failing at networking, essentially. You need to be eyeball to eyeball, belly to belly with the other person.
Well, is Skype enough, though? That's one way to be face-to-face in digital.
You would think, but in many a business deal and in many a relationship, it may start out on Skype, but ultimately people want to meet face-to-face. Many a time I've started a business transaction or a conversation on Skype. It's never a comfortable feeling. There's always the technical glitches. People are not at their best when they're on Skype. They're sitting perhaps in their living room or their bedroom or in their basement office. I want to see people in their business casual or their suit and really look at them in the eye and get the measure of the man or woman.
And that's the important point, I think, because it occurred to me as we were thinking about Skype and the computer and networking, you could be in a little corner of your basement set up to look like an office, and you could be a fraud.
Absolutely. The most important thing in networking is to become more well-known, to increase your sphere of influence. The more people that know who you are, the more that they can get to like you. And when they like you, then they trust you. When they trust you, they want to do business with you or refer you to other people.
All right. I get so much crap, and that's the only other way to describe it, email, every day because of the show primarily, that how do you sort through, though, to make who, to decide who's a good overture and who belongs in the junk pile?
Well, I'm a victim of this. I can't tell you how many emails I get in a day, and they're actually my lowest priority, frankly. You know, I've been running my own networking event now since late 2011, and typically when I meet someone face-to-face, there's that chemistry there that I know that there is a possibility that the other person and myself, we could be doing really good things, not only to help each other's businesses, but the greater community. And that enables me to really, you know, separate those people that will be a waste of my time from those people that will be valuable, and for people that I will be valuable for. Now, that being said, when you do physical network a lot, you are meeting a lot of people. You do have to make that determination of who you're going to have a one-on-one with. who you're going to, after a networking event or a networking opportunity, who you're going to take a cup of coffee with, and value their time and your time. That's when you can use your tools. That's when you can use those digital tools, and you can reach out to someone possibly on Zoom, or in a conference room or on LinkedIn or social media, when you actually know who they are. So it's not just a cold call. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Although with my LinkedIn account, I get overtures from people who I have no idea who they are.
Yes, it's amazing. It's almost like LinkedIn's got a little bit out of control, and you do have to go in and tamp it down. And I'm not saying eliminate people from your LinkedIn, but group it properly with people that you actually know and people that you would like to know and people that you have no interest in seeing. And you have to beware on LinkedIn. There are a lot of scams that are happening on that platform recently.
Mm. All right. Now, you mentioned networking events, face-to-face events for networking. What are those?
Yes. Well, my company, Rockstar Connect, we do 155 business networking events per month currently. And our form of networking is just a casual mix and mingle. They're very enjoyable. They're easy to do. It's a great way to meet people, you know, over some finger foods and, you know, possibly an alcoholic drink or not. And when you go to an event like that and you meet people, you have the opportunity to get their business card, to speak with them, and to set up that coffee meeting later on or that Zoom meeting, because now you actually have met that person.
So if I understand what we've said so far then, it's really a question of you can't do one without the other if you want to be effective.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I think you can do the physical without the digital, but the digital without the physical is less than ideal. So now, today, because of all the digital opportunities we have, because of Facebook, because of Zoom and LinkedIn and other groups, you can really have a large sphere of influence and touch on them on a regular basis to have a very good network. But it's just a tool. Just like I imagine when people first got telephones, they said, wow, I can really grow my network. But that wasn't the only way. You know, the only way to grow your network, the reality is you had to go and meet people face-to-face. And it's still the same thing. So you can go to a networking event like the ones that our company throws for our hosts. You can go to a conference or a convention. But people don't even think of other places they can network. You can network when you go get your cup of coffee at Starbucks, or you're having breakfast at McDonald's, or when you're at the grocery store shopping. There's a lot of opportunities to meet people face-to-face. And my general feeling is if someone is within swinging distance of me, they're a potential friend or a business associate. It just requires starting up that conversation.
Well, when you say networking with your cup of coffee or your breakfast at McDonald's, how do you do that? I mean, that's usually fast. Get your food, eat it, and get out.
Well, I have to tell you, there's a guy in this town, a real estate agent who is very successful. He moved from New York to Raleigh, North Carolina. Big difference from someone from the Bronx and someone from Raleigh, North Carolina, at least in the mind of people from Raleigh, North Carolina. This gentleman simply went up to the counter at Starbucks, and he said, I'm going to buy coffee for everybody that comes in here for the next hour. I'll be sitting over there if they want to come say hi to me. And, you know, he was able to establish a lot of friendships, relationships for the cost of a cup of coffee. So you can really network everywhere. When I first started off selling real estate myself, and, you know, I am a real estate agent as well, I would go into the grocery store and I would help people, you know, take a package from the top, or I would make a recommendation of a box of cereal or a recipe that I really enjoyed, or give them a coupon that I had in my hand, and that would start a conversation, and frequently that would start a relationship that would end up in me helping someone buy or sell a house. So if you are conscious of the world around you, you're actually always networking or have the opportunity to do so.
Now, when you mention places like Starbucks or the grocery store, I see a lot of flyers on bulletin boards, a lot of piles and cards in card racks. Is that enough?
No, that's not. I mean, people view that as, you know, gross promotion, and they see it as, you know, junk mail, but in the physical space. Starting up conversations, that's something altogether different. That's part of being a human being, the social animal that we are. Rather than just walking through your day with blinders on and avoiding all the opportunity that's around you and the love and charity that you can share in your community, instead, be conscious of who's around you, who you can help, because when you give, you're rewarded with great material and spiritual abundance.
So when you show up at the neighborhood community fair or building a house kind of thing, that's a form of networking.
Absolutely. Now, that being said, business cards are fantastic. I have great business cards. They're a wonderful tool for when people want your information. Many people thought business cards were dead with the age of, you know, cell phones and texting people's phone numbers. But people like a physical representation of you. So just getting off subject a little, go find a graphic designer that shares your vision and print out the best business cards that you have, because they're your little billboards when you're going out into the business world.
Okay. How about flyers? What do you do with them? Anything?
I'm not a huge fan of flyers. So we'll have people come to our to the Rockstar Connect networking events, and they may have flyers, or they may have a clipboard, and they're taking people's names. It's very aggressive. That's a piece of material that people can't put in their pocket. It's burdensome, although it weighs, a fraction of an ounce, a couple grams. When it's in someone's hands, you might as well have handed them, a weight set that weighed a few hundred pounds, because people don't want your flyer. If they have your business card and they don't push it into them, if they ask for it and they're interested in you, they'll follow up. If they gave you their card, that's an invitation for you to continue the conversation with them outside of the venue that you're in.
What about?
I would avoid flyers.
What about robocalls?
Robocalls are horrendous. They're successful, I mean, for some marketers, but if you want to have a networking experience where you are actually bringing someone into your sphere of influence, I don't feel that robocalls are acceptable, or text, unless they're solicited. You know, if someone opts in to a robot call through your program, then it's acceptable to do it. But why not just make a personal call? So for our networking events, frequently, people that have already gone to our events and we hope enjoyed them, we'll call them and give them a reminder. But it's a person doing it. It's not a robot.
An important thing, I always like to talk to the person I'm talking to as opposed
yes.
to talking to a machine.
Yes. In this day and age, you know, if your organization wants to make phone calls, they have to be aware that there are many things in place to prevent you from doing so. Some people will go straight to voicemail, but in my network, I want people to know they can reach out to me on the phone. So instead of saying, you know, go to my calendar, and I am a busy person, instead of going to my calendar, my electronic calendar, and booking something, just give me a call. If I'm on the other line, I'll give you a call back.
That's the problem. A lot of people don't give you that call back.
I don't think I've ever not returned a phone call. So
no, that's very much to your credit, Stephen.
It's very much to my success. If everybody else is not returning phone calls, or many people do not return phone calls, and you are one that does, it's greatly appreciated. It helps you establish that trust with other people. Because they take it as, believe me, they take it as an insult when you don't call them back.
And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Stephen David Elliott. Stephen is an expert in networking in the digital age. whether you have a networking event, you still need your computer to do it as well. Computers, face-to-face, it's a happy marriage if you want to grow your business. Stephen, I know you have a book.
Yes, very excited. Just recently released.
Tell me about
it. It's called Mingle, The Art of Face-to-Face Networking in the Digital Era.
Do you have a website?
It can be, our website is rockstarconnect.com, but the best place to get that book is on Amazon. Just look for Stephen David Elliott and the name Mingle. Just type that in. And for the listeners, I put up a special e-copy for you that's only 99 cents.
Now, that's a bargain. Absolutely.
It's a really great book. It's an actionable journal. You can pick it up. It's slim. You can read it very quickly, but then you go back to it again and again for strategies to improve your networking and grow your sphere of influence.
Now, Stephen, I have a lot of friends in the nonprofit world. Does this stuff work for them as well?
Absolutely. I started off networking in the nonprofit world. And I was a young 20 years of age, and I had an employer who absolutely hated networking. And because of that, she sent me to every opportunity that arose to network so she could avoid it. She was almost a networking phobe. In the meantime, because of that networking, I met people that quickly accelerated my career in the not-for-profit sector, and I went way beyond my employer in a very quick period of time. And also, I was able to get the information and resources and connections that I needed to help my clients who were elderly people. I was a social worker and ran a program. So it's very effective in the not-for-profit sphere.
What's ahead for your work in the profit nonprofit sector?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, Peter?
What's ahead for you?
What's a hit for me, you said?
Ahead. The future.
Oh, a future not-for-profit. Well, I like to work with not-for-profits. That's fantastic. But of course, what I do is for-profit, Rockstar Connect. We're growing all the time. We're growing in Canada. We're all over the United States. We're launching in the new year a platform for people to network online and establish those connections in the digital world so they can then bring it forward at our live event. So I would like to help other people host their own networking events and have a great impact on their local business community.
And if people want to get in touch with Rockstar Connect, what do you want them to do?
Just go to our website, rockstarconnect.com. You can make a query there, and you'll be connected to someone on our staff. If you want to speak with me specifically, make that request, and I'll make certain that I return your call back.
And I'd like to say thank you to Stephen David Elliott, rock star of the Connect world, for joining us here this morning. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Peter. Always my pleasure.
My pleasure as well. And you've been listening to Conversation here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. It's a cold morning out there, but warm thoughts to those people of Thousand Oaks, California. That tragedy in the bar, it shouldn't have happened. All this and more coming up here on 94 WIP. More in just a bit. And we're back. It's Conversation. My name's Peter Solomon. And what a week it's been. From the election day to the massacre in Thousand Oaks, California, and a whole lot more. And that's causing a whole lot of stress. And that's what we're going to talk about with my next guest, Dr. John Huber from Mainstream Mental Health. He's been on before, and he'll probably be on again. He has things to say to us about our psychological well-being. Good morning, Dr. Huber.
Good morning, Peter. How are you?
I'm fine. God, we're stressed, aren't we, as a people?
Totally stressed out, exactly. I think a lot of us think we're doing the right stuff to reduce our stress. We're, escaping reality through social media, through playing video games. And a lot of times that can be the worst thing for us, actually.
Or through drinking, through drugs, through gambling, through sex, you name it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Some of the best things that we can do for ourselves, actually, is exercise. As simple as it sounds, it doesn't have, you don't have to become Arnold Schwarzenegger. You just need to go for a 20-minute walk around your neighborhood. Simple as that.
All right. Now, two things I specifically want to focus on and get your insights on. One is, of course, the election, and the other thing is the recent massacre in Thousand Oaks, California. They're very different, but in some respects they're the same, I think. What do you think?
Well, they both can cause extreme pain and extreme stress in that same way. You know, if your candidate doesn't win, or, you know, if you are totally inundated with people who don't like the fact that your candidate did win, that can be very problematic for yourself. So we have to then step away and look at the massacre and the shooting. And if we look at the data that's actually out there, we have less than 300 deaths by those types of mass shootings every year. And I know that sounds really bad, but the reality of it is we have between 36 and 38,000 homicides every year. So we're talking less than 0.1% of deaths are caused by this. So that should help us rationalize and say, hey, I can still go to that concert. I can still go to the shopping mall. I can still send my kids to school. To put it in perspective, we lose about 1,200 people every year to drowning in your bathtub. It still doesn't make any of those things less stressful or less scary, but it does give us kind of a place to work from. You know, there's 1 in 300 chance that you're going to drown when you go to the ocean. But what do? We focus on sharks, which is something like 1 in 15 million chance of getting bit by a shark.
Well, that's interesting to me. You talked about bathtubs. Nobody went stressfully nuts when Whitney Houston drowned in her bathtub, but yet we're going stressfully nuts over Thousand Oaks or the synagogue in Pittsburgh.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I suggest that, you know, we kind of go back to the old method of collecting our news, you know, for the morning news show, you know, such as yours, or then after work when you're eating dinner, watching the news then, and then right before bed, instead of what we get on our smartphones. And that's about every 5 to 10 minutes we get an update on the news. And sometimes there's nothing changed except for now you got a new blurb on your phone and you read that headline. And it keeps us in that fight or flight mechanism the whole time. We never get downtime.
Is part of the problem, though, we take politics too seriously?
Well, I think we take it too seriously. I also think we take it too personally. And part of that, it's the politicians themselves. You know, when they start losing an argument and they start to call each other names, and, you know, it's impossible to prove a negative. So if you call somebody a bigot, you can't prove you're not a bigot. The onus actually should be on the person who claims that you're a bigot to prove that you're a bigot. And we don't go that way. We look to the person who got identified as a bigot and say, okay, prove to us you're not. And you can't.
That's like that old question, when did you stop beating your wife?
That is exactly what it is doing. That is the exact thing that's happening.
But at the same time, a lot of charges are getting flung around that can be proven, because we have tape like never before of people saying things that we wish they hadn't.
Exactly, exactly. And I think, you know, we as a society have been hit with this smartphone in 2007. So we're talking, these are 11 years old. And the societal standards, the laws regulating these things and events have not caught up with the technology. For example, should we be, you know, treating a 10 or a 13-year-old child who does something crazy on a phone 20 years later, should we hold them to the same standard that we hold an adult to it? And we haven't set those limits or parameters at this point.
What do you think about that question? Should we hold them to the same accountability?
Well, I know developmentally their brains are not the same. They're not functioning like adult brains until halfway through their 20s. Some people even towards the end of their 20s, 28, 29 years of age, before their brains are fully developed and they start acting like adults and making adult-type decisions. Now, we always know there's outliers. There's always individuals out there who, you know, are ahead of the curve. But the majority of people, it's 24, 25 years of age. Ask any insurance agent. They'll tell you the driving rates, the insurance drops at that point. And there's a reason why. It's because they don't think like rational adults think. It's more like the old adage, you know, don't ever stick around when somebody says, here, hold my beer, you know, because okay. You know what's going to happen next.
Absolutely. Now, I have a very dear friend who, during this election season, spent a lot of time screaming at the television, especially when one person involved in the election had a lot to say. What do you think about that as a strategy?
Screaming at the television. Well, if you're by yourself, I don't think it's a problem unless it affects you and you're not able to sleep. You're not able to, you know, hold down your meal, those types of things. But if you're around people, particularly kids and maybe other family members, but kids in particular, you're not helping them stay calm and cool and collected. You're actually creating anxiety in those children. So I don't recommend it if there are kids around there. And if your spouse is around, you know, you have to think about your spouse and their sanity. You have to sleep sometime. And if they're not being able to have a calm, peaceful life, and you're causing that stress because you're yelling at a television, you never know. I had a client whose wife used to paint his toenails and then stick the toenails to the sheets. And so when he'd wake up in the morning, he knew she was mad at him.
Now, just when we thought maybe all the hubbub would stop with Election Day and the results, no matter what you thought of them, it seems to be continuing. People still flinging names, flinging mud at each other.
They are, exactly. And, you know, it doesn't even matter if you watch the news or not, because the people are doing it at the coffee, you know, in the business, at the water cooler. When you go to work, everybody is talking about it. And we're talking about the new elections. Well, okay, they're not over. Now we're looking at court litigation in Florida. You know, this is just a stretch for everybody. And we're not getting any downtime. In fact, I've had patients in my practice who came in as we were approaching the election here last week, and they'd been in my office for a couple of months, but they told me they never felt like the political ads and all the politicking on TV and on the radio ever finished after the 2016 election, because every single story seemed, in their mind at least, to be related to politics. So they got no downtime for 2 years, and were rather distraught that maybe we'll have no downtime for another 2 years before the 2020 election.
Well, probably it's a reasonable fear, though, considering the House is now Democratic, the Senate remains Republican, and it's going to be 2 years of mudslinging, probably.
Exactly. I had a college professor once, though, who told me that, you know, he liked having the two houses in different party control, because he said it slowed government down, and there's nothing gets you in more trouble than a government moving really fast and throwing out new regulations and new laws and everything else really quickly.
Okay.
he was a psychology professor, not a political science professor, well, whatever that's worth.
I can see his point, certainly, because the last 2 years seem to have whizzed by, and there's been a lot of changes a lot of people aren't happy with. But at the same time, when we vote, people voted one way, it seems, for the House races and another way for the Senate races. What do you think that's about?
Well, I'd like to be able to say that it's our rational selves going through and picking the best candidate that we believe is there for the job, regardless of party politics. But I don't know if I can say that. I mean, is it maybe, you know, the individuals whose races were up and they were looking to get reelected or win an election, you know, maybe the House was in more Democrat-run states and the Senate was in more Republican-controlled states. I haven't looked at that. Again, I'm not a politician or a political science major, but I want to believe it's because, you know, the rational side of our voters actually took place and made rational decisions based on who they thought had the best platform.
From your lips to God's ears. I'm just not sure that's the case.
I don't think I have any proof that it is, but that's the naive side of me in politics wants to say.
Well, I would propose it's not naive as much as it is optimistic.
Okay.
That's another discussion. All right. What do we do, though? Because we've got 2 years to the next election, 2 years to survive with our sanity intact.
Boy, now that's a tough call. I recommend, again, don't spend all your time in front of your screens, whether it's a tablet, a computer, your cell phone, your television for that matter. Spend some time. Give yourself 20 minutes a day. Get up in the morning 20 minutes early. Go for a walk around your neighborhood. Turn off your phones. Turn off all your communication devices when you're having dinner with your family. That tells them that, hey, you guys are more important than that phone call I might get or that text. And it puts the emphasis on what's really important, which are your friends and family right there in front of you at that moment. That'll bring some centering together. It'll encourage your children to learn how to manage their internet time. And, you know, you can tell kids all day long, but what they hear is what you do. So role model that for your kids. Don't just tell them to do it. And go ahead.
In fact, aren't there people who can turn it off almost to the point of being addicted?
Well, they are addicted. In fact, we know that you get stimulation from your social media, and those apps actually trigger dopamine releases in your brain, much like individuals who use heroin, for example. And you start feeling kind of down in the dumps, and you have to go back and get that dopamine burst. Now, it's not a huge burst. It's not like you're actually using heroin, but it has the same mechanism, and it's just a little trickle. And what we know is it takes about a week, and you don't have that issue anymore. You're not craving to get back on the social media. So take a week vacation. In fact, this summer, except for my cell phone, I got rid of all my social media apps for 2 months, and all I did was, you know, what I have to do for work and news media. But I got rid of Snapchat and Instagram and Facebook and isolated myself, and it was amazing how it freed me up.
And you're listening to Conversation here on 94WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest is mental health expert John Huber. John comes to us from a very respected mental health organization down there in Texas and has a lot to say, in this case, a lot to say about stress and the stress caused by Election Day and recent events and what we can do to survive. All this and more coming up here on 94WIP, the WIP time, 6:44. And we're back. We're talking with Dr. John Huber here on Conversation. Dr. Huber is the founder and director of Mainstream Mental Health. Mainstream Mental Health, all one word, .org is his website. And he's got a lot to say, in this case, about stress and the current social political scene. My name's Peter Solomon. Dr. Huber, though, it also seems to me that recent events in particular have increased in a lot of people the level of paranoia, conspiracy theories. The Republicans are trying to steal the election. No, the Democrats are trying to steal the election. No, the right wing, the left wing. How do we sort through all that, or is it all nuts?
Well, remember that whatever happens, life goes on. You still got to get up and feed the kids in the morning. You still got to go pay the electric bill. Still got to pay your rent and your mortgage. And that all this stress and anxiety about what might happen is not productive at the very least, and it can become paranoia and actually interfere with your life as far as your productivity at work, your relationships with your family, your relationships with your friends, and that triggers a whole lot of internal problems medically. the stress, the anxiety, the paranoia, all increases your stress hormones like cortical steroids and things like that that we release. And that increases your risk for strokes, for heart attacks, for clogged arteries, increases your blood pressure. And it can cause respiratory problems for people who, for example, may smoke and like that. So it's not a healthy thing to do. We have to put things into perspective. Again, we still got to get up and pay rent in the morning.
But there's also an old saying, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you.
Well, exactly. You know, that is true. But, wow, how important you must be for the whole, you know, government and a whole wing of, say, the GOP or the Democratic Party and the DNC to go after that and try to destroy your life. Pretty crazy.
Because it seems to me there are two opposite ends of a spectrum that we're on.
Yes.
One end is we've got to have faith in democracy, and no matter what intentions might be going on in the Capitol building or the White House, democracy will prevail. That's what America's about. That's what the Constitution's about. That should be what the Supreme Court is about. And on the other side of that is people are looking more and more at what's going on and feeling like it's straight out of the Joseph Goebbels, Adolf Hitler playbook.
Yeah, and it's very, very scary. And, I've gone back to reading Tom Clancy books, and it's like, wow, you know, we used to be afraid of other countries coming after us, and now we're afraid of our own country doing it. And it's funny how a few years can shift our attention. And why is that? And I think a lot of it has to do with this 24/7, every second of the day news cycle, not the three times a day we used to have, but this every minute, every second. And our minds wander. We're not being productive at work. We're not focused on our schoolwork if you're in college. And you start hearing all this stuff, and those thoughts are going on in your mind, and your imagination runs free. And it's pretty easy to believe some of those black helicopters, even if they're not actually following you.
But then how do we maintain a reasonable level of awareness without going overboard?
Well, we need to be informed, and what that means is doing more than just reading the headlines. A lot of times, the headlines are there to get your attention, and they actually don't actually do justice to what is actually written in the story below. So we need to pay more attention to content, and like I used to tell my students in 21 years of teaching at college and university is, oftentimes, the most important thing in a story is what they don't tell you.
Such as?
Well, you know, if they don't want you to see both sides of the story and they're only painting one picture, you know, maybe they're not giving you a complete picture. Maybe all these things are so insignificant that they're claiming is going to happen, and statistically unlikely, but look at all the benefits we can get on the other hand, or vice versa. You know, one, you know, you go to the GOP and they're telling you if you get this bill passed, then all of a sudden, you know, your taxes are going to go up and businesses are not going to hire people and all this. Yet the actual amount of taxes, if it were to go up, if you look at, you know, the business office, what is that? The Congressional Business Office may actually only be, you know, 1 or 2/10 of a percentage point that it's going to go up. But no, it's going up. So they start streaking terror in people's minds. So what they're not telling you is the details. They're telling you the scare information, not the details.
So one recommendation you have then, if I hear you correctly, is don't get scared too early. Check out your information, look at numerous websites, numerous sources, and come to your own conclusion.
Exactly. And in fact, you know, the majority of fear that we have that causes us to react to things in a bad way tends to be fear caused by the unknown. not knowing what's going to happen, and educating ourselves a little bit and maybe going to alternative sites. You know, I always recommend that you do read the article, not the headline, and then do a quick search of international news and see what other countries are talking about, what's going on, because there may be some information in there that we're not getting through the AP or whatever. So it's always wise to investigate.
Well, I think that is an important point. No matter what your source, politically conservative or politically liberal, you have to look at what they're telling you and what they're not telling you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and we create our own fear because we don't know. So get out there, educate yourself, and don't be afraid to ask questions. But the trick is to know what questions need to be asked, and that comes through experience.
And it occurs to me that maybe that old line from Betty Davis in All About Eve, fasten your seatbelt, it's going to be a bumpy ride.
Oh, yes.
It talks about the next 2 years. And I'd like to say thank you to Dr. John Huber. Comes to us from mainstreammentalhealth.org. That's the web address. Thank you, Dr. Huber.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, Peter.
My pleasure. Anytime. And you've been listening to Conversation here on 94 WIP. Stay tuned for WIP Sunday. If you can't, thank you, Phil Jackson, this morning's producer, and to my dear wife, Ann Tideman-Solomon, this morning's producer. Couldn't do the show without you. Stay warm. Stay involved. Nothing left to say but remember our veterans. Thank you for your service. Tomorrow's Veterans Day. And for those people who made the ultimate sacrifice, thank you for the sacrifice your families made. All this and more coming up here on 94 WIP, the WIP time, 6:55. Good morning, and the conversation continues here on 94 WIP as we ease on into WIP Sunday, and a chilly but sunny WIP day it promises to be. So despite the cold air, good conversation always here with us on 94 WIP. And before we get started with this morning's interview, I want to give you a note for your calendar. It seems a little early to talk about holiday festivities, but December's not that far away. And with December comes a free Messiah concert. The Messiah by Handel is being presented on December 2nd at 4 p.m. at the First Presbyterian Church in Germantown, 35 West Chelton. First Presbyterian Church in Germantown, 35 West Chelton. Beautiful music of a sacred nature, but at the same time, good for lifting your spirits, especially after that last interview I did, folks, and good to get you in the mood for the holiday crazies. So no matter where you go, consider First Presbyterian Church, Germantown, 35 West Chelton, Handel's Messiah, 4 p.m. Thank you. And when we come back in just a bit, we're going to talk about an issue that no matter how things change, still is out there. We're going to talk about redlining, racism, and a whole lot more coming up here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. More in just a bit. And we're back, and we're going to talk about an issue that's politics and social and our living together happily ever after, the issue of redlining, racism, and a whole lot more, as I'm welcoming Linda Gartz, author of the new book, Redlined, a memoir of race, change, and a fractured community in 1960 Chicago. Good morning, Linda Gartz.
Good morning, Peter. I'm glad to be here.
Pleased to have you as well. Chicago, 1960. Take us back there, please.
Chicago, 1960. Well, in Chicago, 1960, I was entering seventh grade, and I lived on the west side of Chicago. The west side of Chicago, where I lived, is about a five-mile direct line from downtown Chicago. If people have been to Chicago, that should be a good visual. We lived in a neighborhood called West Garfield Park. Garfield Park is a huge, beautiful park with a famous, world-famous conservatory. And those who lived west of the park were called in West Garfield Park. And it was a vibrant community. There were two intersecting streets, Pulaski and Madison. That's the same Madison you'll find downtown. And there we had shops of every kind you can imagine, multiple clothing shops. We had delis. We had movie theaters. We had hardware stores, bakeries, and so on. So you could really, an AMP, a great AMP, you could walk from our home a block away to any of these, you know, commercial wonders when you think about it when you don't have them. So that was our neighborhood. Now, there were, of course, other neighborhoods, too. There was the south side of Chicago, which was primarily black due to redlining, and also the near west side of Chicago that would have been nearer to downtown than our neighborhood was. And during the 1950s, this city, like many northern cities, saw a huge influx of African Americans because of the Great Migration. And if your viewers, I don't know if you want me to go off there now, but the Great Migration is kind of critical to the story of how neighborhoods became so segregated and where people were able to live when they fled the Jim Crow South. So I don't want to go on too long in case you wanted to focus on other things.
Well, please go give us a taste.
Okay. So the African Americans started heading north in the Great Migration. It actually started around World War I and then gained terrific speed after World War II. As most of your viewers probably know, Jim Crow laws were very much in place in the South during this time, that they were fleeing, and young men were being lynched with impunity. Young women could be, black women could be raped with impunity. They had separate drinking fountains, separate swimming pools, separate schools. Some, if there were only one swimming pool, blacks couldn't go in it. If there was only one amusement park, blacks couldn't go to it. So it was really a codified system of racial apartheid. In the one story I read, I think it was Black Boy, growing up in the Jim Crow South, he speaks of how he was not allowed to go to the library. He had to get a special note from his boss, who was white, that would allow him to take books out of the library, but only in the boss's name. So it was just segregation on every level. And the African Americans were paying taxes for these public amenities, such as swimming pools and universities where black people were not allowed to attend. And that was going on throughout throughout the early part of the century. And then, of course, we had African-American veterans serve in World War II. But when they came back, they were not allowed to take advantage of the veterans bill that allowed so many people, people who'd served in the war to go to college. And one of the terrible things that happened during this time, this is now during the Roosevelt administration, 1933, was that the Roosevelt administration brought into law something called HOLC, H-O-L-C. It stood for Homeowners Loan Corporation. And Homeowners Loan Corporation was meant to help jumpstart the housing market. It wasn't a bad thing to start. But what happened was they sent people all around the country. They used real estate agents everywhere in the country, certainly in Philadelphia and in other major cities, and they color-coded neighborhoods to determine where it was safe to give loans. And they used a color-coding key that indicated that green was safe for loans, totally safe for loans. Blue was pretty safe. Yellow was called definitely declining on the map, and red was hazardous. That's the name it was given, and that meant no loans at all were to be given. They were too risky. Well, there could be a number of reasons a neighborhood was colored red. If it had dilapidated housing and apartments were doubled up by people, they were breaking housing laws. But one thing for sure is that if one African-American person moved into a neighborhood, that entire neighborhood was redlined, and neither whites nor blacks could get any kind of housing loans. By that, I mean they couldn't get a mortgage, and they couldn't get housing loans like home equity loans to fix a sagging roof or a sagging porch or broken windows or whatever needed to be done that people use home equity loans for today. So this really caused African Americans not to be able to invest in property for decades, from 1933 until 1968, when the Fair Housing Act was passed. But we still don't see the end of it. It's no longer legal, but it's like so many things with race. There's a lot of things that aren't legal, but that still happen, and people of color can certainly tell anybody how they feel marginalized and left out in many cases, even though the laws have changed. So that's kind of the overview of how this redlining came about. Oh, and I should mention the FHA was very involved in this, too. They would not underwrite any loans that were for any kind of housing units that included one black person renting or buying. So that's kind of a quick overview, if that helps.
And how did that fit in with your family and your experience?
Well, my neighborhood, as I mentioned, was West Garfield Park. My grandparents on my father's side were immigrants. They were ethnic Germans who had come to America in 1911, and they only had a fourth grade education. My grandfather was a very determined man, and he finally landed a job in West Garfield Park on the corner of Pulaski and Madison. But he decided that his real role was going to be in, he wanted to own real estate like so many immigrants do, so he started in the janitorial business. Well, okay, so that neighborhood was my father's neighborhood from 1912 on. He was born there in 1914. He grew up there. He saw the neighborhood rising. When he met my mother in the 1940s, my mom had been raised Catholic, but she married into the Lutheran faith, which was my dad's faith, at the local Bethel Lutheran Church. When the kids came along, that was our church. And this was an all-white neighborhood. In the beginning, it was more ethnic, but in 1950, the census shows that West Garfield Park was 99.75% white. I love that 0.75%. Just ticks it up a little more. But what was happening because of the Great Migration, as I mentioned earlier, African Americans fleeing these very onerous Jim Crow laws that targeted them, they fled to the north in droves. And in the 1950s, 30,000 African-Americans were arriving in Chicago every year, but they were stuffed into neighborhoods on the south and near west side, as I mentioned. But the areas that they lived kind of inexorably grew as more and more blacks flocked to the city. So these neighborhoods, as I mentioned, you couldn't get loans. Mostly blacks were renters at the time. But because the infrastructure was, bearing so much weight, so to speak, from the influx of people who didn't have a place to stay, many times apartment buildings that were meant for maybe 10 or 18 families had 40 families in them. You know, they'd have three families in one apartment building. It sounds like when we think of Russia today. Toilets broke. Sometimes landlords stuffed sinks into closets and said, here's your kitchen. So the infrastructure in these neighborhoods was breaking. Blacks were desperate for housing, but whites were adamantly against having blacks move into their all-white neighborhoods. And one reason was that they were certain that African Americans were going to bring slum-like conditions to their communities. And actually, in 1953, a black couple purchased a home in what was all white South Deering on Chicago's South Side. And for months, white crowds protested and rioted. They hurled bricks, shot off pistols, and injured and attacked black passersby. And, a CBS News reporter was reporting on this, and he went to one woman protesting and said, why are you protesting so adamantly against African-Americans living into this neighborhood? And she actually said on camera, and I'm going to quote, every place they've taken over, they've turned into a slum. So that was the prevailing attitude, is that African Americans would destroy a neighborhood. But what people, what white people didn't understand is that because of this overcrowding, because of the fact that the city oftentimes didn't pick up garbage properly in these neighborhoods, often polluting industries were put in these neighborhoods, which made the neighborhoods look more dirty and more slum-like than, excuse me, than they normally would have. There were external reasons for this. It wasn't that, oh, you know, a black person just is going to ruin the neighborhood, or they don't care about their property. So that was what started happening. But even our family, you know, we didn't know about these racist lending laws. I'd say most whites didn't. Our neighborhood, when my parents bought a two flat in 1949, well, I realize now when I look at one of these homeowners loan corporation maps, and I will tell your listeners in a minute where they can look at them. That area that my parents bought their house in was labeled yellow, definitely declining, and it was surrounded by redlined areas, which is a danger. And the commentary that was made on the side of this is shocking to today's ears, but it said regarding our neighborhood, threatened by Negro encroachment. Or sometimes the realtors would write, Italians moving in. So foreigners were also looked down upon as lowering property values, probably because they could only afford, you know, lower income housing, and therefore maybe that housing wasn't as well kept up. But that's sort of the backdrop to our family's lives there. We had considered this our neighborhood. And in 1963, as the civil rights movement was really gaining steam, if your listeners may recall, if they're old enough, in May of 1963 is when the Birmingham Children's March took place, and the Birmingham Fire Department used high-powered and high-pressure hoses to roll them along the street, and they sicked dogs on them. That was in May of 63. Then in June of 63, Governor Wallace stood in front of the University of Alabama, and he had said at his inauguration, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. And he refused to let in black students whose families had paid for this university. So that's when John F. Kennedy sent federal troops down to force him to let those African-American students go to their own university. Kennedy got on TV that night and sort of begged Americans, white Americans, to please treat their fellow African Americans fairly. The day after he made that speech, almost as if in a vicious rejoinder, Medgar Evers, who is the field secretary for the NAACP, was murdered in his driveway right in front of his wife and kids. Mm-mm-mm. And 10 days after that, the first African American moved onto our block. So in our that experience was like every night on TV you see the nation exploding in some sort of horrible racial event, and now we had a racial event in our own neighborhood.
And we're going to find out how Linda's family dealt with that racial event and a whole lot more when we come back in just a bit. Linda, got to run a few commercials here, so stay with me. And we're listening to 94 WIP, WIP Sunday. We'll come back in just a bit with Linda Gartz, author of Redlined, a memoir of race, change, and fractured community in 1960s Chicago. The WIP Times, 719. And we're back. My guest this morning, Linda Gartz, author of Redlined, a memoir of race, change, and a fractured community in 1960s Chicago. My name's Peter Solomon. Linda, what you're describing almost sounds like the introduction to the brilliant Lorraine Hansberry play, Raisin in the Sun.
Well, it is a very much the same story, and actually, it was the Hansberries who had bought a home in a community in Chicago on the South Side, and it was a sale that technically shouldn't have taken place because the person who sold to them had bought the home with a restrictive covenant. Now, for those of your listeners who aren't sure what a restrictive covenant was, not only were areas redlined back at that time for 35 years, but sometimes homes would be sold with the understanding that the purchaser would never sell this home to a black person, and sometimes to a Jewish person. So that was called restrictive covenants. And this woman in the neighborhood where Hansberry's father had purchased sued them to kick them out. They said, we shouldn't be having any black people here. There's a restrictive covenant. It was brought to the Supreme Court eventually, and Hansberry's won. So in 1948, these restrictive covenants were declared illegal, but the redlining was still going on. And yes, in Raisin in the Sun, I remember seeing that as a kid. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I remember an African-American family wants to move into a white neighborhood. And then same thing happened then in our neighborhood. An African-American family purchased a home two doors down the street from us. The old man had died, and everybody was a Twitter as to what was going to happen to the house because there was concern that it would be sold to an African-American. That was a great concern because white people felt that it would affect their property values. And in fact, it did. In matter of fact, even Isabel Wilkerson in her book, The Warmth of Other Suns, says that, yes, it did affect white property values, but not for the reasons that whites thought. And so it turned out this black family moved in, and my mother... diaries, and see, this is why this book was written, is because I have thousands and thousands of pages of letters and diaries where they documented their lives for the whole 20th century. So she, you know, she wrote that she was very concerned, you know, should they sell, should they stay? And whatever it was, they owned the property, and I think it was harder for them to move than, let's say, renters. And they just were kind of bold people, so they decided to stay. You know, I don't think they said to themselves, we're great liberals and therefore we're going to stay. No, it was just maybe inertia. I don't know. I really don't know. But the result of that decision is that as the neighborhood became more and more populated by African Americans because whites started fleeing by the thousands, we got to know our neighbors. And Mom actually said later, you know, I'm not at all unhappy in this changing neighborhood. I like my neighbors, and I like the young girls who live down the street, and they're so kind. They help me carry my groceries. So it goes to show you, I think, one of the main things is, especially living in this time where we try to demonize the other, right, that once you get to know the person who's labeled the other, different from you, that many times, you know, you find that there is a real person behind the stereotypes. And I think that is exactly what happened with my parents. So piece by piece, you know, house by house, the neighborhood went from basically mostly white in 1960 census. And I would say by 1964 to 65, we were among the last whites in the neighborhood. And our block, within one summer, four houses were sold to African Americans, about half the stock. And by the end of the school year, it was virtually all African American. So that's something I talk about in my book, too.
You give us an inspiring story, certainly. And Linda, we have a caller this morning, the very patient Brian from West Philadelphia. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Brian.
Yeah, good morning. How you doing? How you doing, Peter?
Fine.
It's a documentary I'll call Hidden Colors by a guy named Tariq Nasir. And when he points out, another guy named Dr. Claude Anderson, and like what they point out, is they say that white supremacy and racism is a system. Let me give you an example. You talk about stuff that happened in the 1950s. That's nothing new. I'm African American. This is still going on even to this day.
Uh-huh.
Even with this last election that just happened, with Stacey Abrams, I was reading comments that was on the internet from the state of Georgia. The guy who actually ran against Mike Brian Kemp, he's a white nationalist. The same thing with Andrew Gillum in the state of Florida. I was listening to CNN. They were saying racism that exists. And I was talking to a college student up here that go to the University of Penn who was telling me that they lived in Florida for the 8 years. And she said in Fort Lauderdale and some areas of Florida, there's a lot of racism that's going on down there. So it's nothing going on. You know, it's nothing new that's underneath the sun. You know, racism is, you know, white supremacy and racism is a system. There are nine areas of it. Education, finance, politics play into it. The criminal justice system is another form of it. So, you know, what you're saying, I understand what you're saying, what happened in the 1950s. It's nothing new. What Dr. Carl Anderson said, he said that black people prospered in the 1950s all the way up to the 1960s. He said all because of what Jackie Robinson did when he broke the color barrier. Black people had the greatest economic power in the history of America, in the world. I mean, you had black people that owned their own bus companies, they owned their own cab companies in Salisbury, South Carolina. I mean, he even spoke about black people, the Negro Leagues that actually happened during that time period. And my thing is this, okay, and I'll say this in closing. Donald Trump's the president. Hello?
Hi, I'm here. I'm listening.
Okay, you know, Donald Trump's the president. The thing that I say, always said this, he's unpeeling something that's been hidden in this country for the last, I don't know how long.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And with him being elected in office, I hear a lot of people that's going up against him that don't like him. But what he's doing, he's unstaving the hidden racism that's been going on. And if you notice, when he became president, all this stuff started coming out.
Mm-hmm.
All this stuff. Even the stuff that happened in Charlottesville.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even the comments that he made. So the thing that I'm saying is that you have to deal with this. This is nothing new for African Americans in this country. I'm black. Like I say, it's nothing new. You know, it's nothing new. Historically, it's been there, and it's going to continue to be there, because I always said this, and it's a straight-up point, okay? I'll say this in closing. Bill Cosby got accused of something that happened in 2004. The Catholic Church, look at this. The Catholic Church had 100 years of child abuse. Has not went to jail.
Mm-hmm.
Had not been convicted of anything. But Bill Cosby, 81 years old, blind, is going to jail for something that he happened in 2004. Now, I'm not saying that whether it's right for what he did or what, or you know, whether it's right or wrong, whatever. But it shows you the level of how the way the criminal justice system is in this country. And nothing would ever be right in this country until things get right within the Constitution. You know, Malcolm X said it. We're really considered three-fourths. We're not considered property, human beings.
Mm-hmm.
We're forced in the Constitution. So, you know, Dr. King said it at the end of his life. People talked about the dream speech and all this other stuff. Dr. King said this. He said America would never, ever shake the disease of racism. He said it on his dying day when he had the Poor People's Campaign. He realized that it was two areas, okay? Classism and racism will always be here, and this is the thing that's going to destroy this country. Thank you for letting me speak.
Okay, well, I appreciate you gave a very good overview of a lot of the issues that are still going on today, and I want to say that first of all, you're absolutely right. I mean, these laws that. Or policies that allowed the federal government to actually put in its rule book that there were no blacks to be given home loans, I think they used the term inharmonious racial groups should not live together. So this is, in a way, this isn't what I'm talking about actually is from the past, kind of what you're talking about, the caller is talking about, that African Americans have really always been treated shamefully in this country. I mean, from the days of slavery. I mean, this is all, you know, tied in with the very America's, what we call, original sin, slavery. I mean, they brought these people against their will to this country. When they released them from slavery, then they, in the South, they put in special laws that would make it easy to round up black people and put them into prison. Kids as young as 12 years old were put into this horrible prison called Parchment Prison and literally worked to death. You know, and then we, you know, we had the whole system of apartheid in the South, but in the North there was still this, you know, entrenched racism as well. And I also would agree with the caller that our president has unpeeled the hidden racism that people felt for a long time felt they shouldn't express, but now they feel they have permission to express it. express it. And especially when you have something like Charlottesville occur, and the president says, well, there's good people on both sides. I mean, he's basically saying these white nationalists are good people. Now, they may love their kids, but everybody loves their kids. You know, that's not a trait to make you a good person in the world. So that's rather disturbing, and I can understand that feeling. And I've met people, I've traveled, you know, just to southern Illinois. I live in the Chicago area, and I've traveled to southern Illinois and met people who are blatantly racist. And what I love is when they say something that's really racist, like, yeah, well, you know, all these blacks get pulled over by the police. You know, that's because they're always doing something wrong. And I'm try to engage in a logical argument with the person saying, well, you know, that's not really the case. And then you'll say, now, I'm not a racist, but, and I hear this all the time. And I think that's something that even the most open-minded of us have to question ourselves when we want to say, I'm not a racist. Because we've all grown up in a society that encourages racial thinking. And I think there are many people today with this young generation, this is the first real chance we have to perhaps put some of this to rest. I think it's going to be hard to ever put it all to rest. And I think also Barack Obama brought out a lot of racism in our society just by the very fact people couldn't stand the fact that they had a black for a president. And then, of course, you had Trump trying to show that he wasn't even born in this country. So I really appreciate your call and the frustration you feel.
Okay, thank you. But read Michelle Alexander's book called The New Jim Crow. She talks about this. Let me say this. What happened was when Dr. King got assassinated in 1968, there were 100 riots, right?
Right.
Richard Nixon put in something called the Malign Neglect Policy. What he did, he targeted inner cities, and he brought the police force in the inner cities. That was the rise of the Black Panther movement that was in Oakland, California.
Mm-hmm.
And what they were teaching was the right to bear arms and all that. That was the Black Panthers movement was about. And also they started the school lunch programs. Now, what happened was during that time period when they did that, okay, she pointed out her book that all the jobs started leaving the United States and started going overseas. And now the prison industrial system is the biggest industry in America. Over, she said, you got more prisoners that are locked up, black men and men of color, that are locked up in the prison system since the days of slavery of 1619.
Yes, I
now,
have.
Think about that.
Yeah, no, I have read her book, as a matter of fact,
and I've seen
the movie.
She pointed out. She said since the days of 1619. Now, if you look at most of the urban areas to where you live at, where predominantly black people and poor white people live at, most of the jobs are gone because what happened was that these past two administrations, regardless, Democrats or Republicans, had shipped all the jobs overseas to places like China, India, and places like that because what happened was they got the school pipelines. They had a big rally here in Philadelphia where I know a person who was organizing to try to stop young people from being incarcerated. And like what it was is that they have a prison pipeline that goes from kids as young as them graduating from high school to the prison system. They target young kids at the age of 11 to be headed into the prison system. They already got them targeted to go to the prison system. So what happened was during that time period from the 1960s all the way up to the crack cocaine epidemic, she speaks about a lot of that. And she talked about the prison, and she talked about the guidelines, the criminal guidelines that they had where they target African American and Latinos and other poor whites towards the prison system. So now the prison system is the biggest industry in the United States, in the world.
Yeah,
we incarcerate more people in America than we do anywhere else in the world.
You're absolutely right.
She pointed out in her book.
Yep.
She pointed out in her book. And Peter, you got to get her on your show because she talks about this openly, and she talks about that with a lot of passion. And she tells you, because her husband's a prosecutor, and what it is she talked about since the day of Dr. King being assassinated, this thing going on, and it's still going on. And she called the prison system is the new plantation. The new plantation.
Right. And then she also talked, and in her book, in her documentary called 13th, have you seen that, sir?
No, I haven't seen
it. That's worth seeing, too, because it basically, there's a lot of Michelle Alexander in that documentary. She is interviewed, and in a very, for readers who may not, like, pick up the book itself, if you're more into visual learning, the movie called The 13th, and that refers to the 13th Amendment. It's a really great way to get the whole background you're talking about, including, like you said, this is a huge business. And so when states want to have prisons built because it gives them jobs. But then, of course, you've got a prison, you've got to fill it. So you've got to come up with ways of creating laws that are going to be able to target, people to fill that prison. And unfortunately, African Americans have been targeted, much more often than whites. And then the other really sad thing about our prison population is probably a third to 50% of the inmates are mentally ill.
Yeah.
And so they don't have the capacity to know that what they've done is wrong. And then you've got poverty, that exacerbates all this because people don't have a chance to get proper food and proper schooling so that they don't know how to even deal with the police. And I think that's, here in Chicago, as you know, we're under a court injunction.
Oh, yeah.
To have our police department reviewed because we had this guy who was torturing people to get concessions out of them.
Right.
Let me say this in closing. Oprah Winfrey, she had a show on where she had a guy who was a black attorney who was talking about a guy who got wrongfully convicted of a crime that happened since 1950. He's been sitting in jail for almost 40 years. With the DNA thing, they found out they had to exonerate him through this state because what happened was he was wrongfully convicted of something that happened in the 1950s. He got wrongfully convicted of a crime that he did not commit. And he told the story. The guy's name is Brian. I can't remember his name. But he wrote a book, too. And it was fascinating because she talked about people on her show called OWN. She talked about people who actually that were wrongfully convicted that was in the prison system. And she had studied this through this guy who was a lawyer who talked about this. And he said that what happened was in the criminal justice system, they were unfair laws because you had a lot of black people that were poor and they were at a disadvantage. So the prosecutors, they took advantage of these people. So they wrongfully convicted somebody and they got like 40 years of this man's life that he will never, ever be able to get back.
All right. Thank you, Brian. Got to go.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
And Linda, you stay with us. I got to run a few more commercials. We'll be back in just a bit with Linda Gartz, author of Redlined, a memoir of race, change, and fractured community in 1960s Chicago. WIP time, 7:43. And we're back into the home stretch with Linda Gartz, author of the new book, Redlined, a memoir of race, change, and fractured community in 1960s Chicago. My name's Peter Solomon. Linda, as we were talking, a couple things flashed into my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I remember as a child wanting to go when my parents went to see Raisin in the Sun. And I was told, no, this is not a movie for children. You can't go.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been a good movie for me to see.
Yeah, it would have been, yeah.
And I also remember the impact that it had. And not only was it a movie, and not some little movie, but a movie with Sidney Poitier, but it was made into a Broadway musical. And, in fact, there was a follow-up play written by another author, Bruce Graham, called Clyburn Park,
mm-hmm.
about what happened to the community the family moved into.
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
it had resonance in our society. And I think that's important to remember. Also here in Philadelphia, there was a neighborhood called Mount Airy, where when people of color moved in, a lot of the real estate companies went, lordy, lordy, the people of color are coming, you better move. And the people in the community, the white people, said no. They weren't moving. And now Mount Airy, East End West Mount Airy, becomes a community that we can point to with pride as being integrated and harmonious.
Mm-hmm. The town I live in, Evanston, where Northwestern University lies, is sometimes also looked at as that's a great interracial community. But we have our own history of redlining here in this town. Yes, our children do go to school. Our white children and our black children go to school together, which is great, because I have to say my two sons went through the system, and they, I think, really benefited from being from getting to know, you know, their African American schoolmates as we did when we moved into the neighborhood. It was like didn't even faze them at all. And we have another town here called Oak Park, and during this, they actually handled the integration better. Oak Park is directly west of where I grew up in the West Side. So again, you could draw a line from the heart of downtown Chicago straight west, go past my house, and be in Oak Park. And they banned for sale signs on the front of houses because they realized that when people saw for sale signs, they panicked, especially if you saw a block that had maybe three or four for sale signs, and that increased the panic of whites, because there were these unscrupulous real estate agents who wanted to make money off of racial fears. And they would tell people, actually come to their door and say things like, you better get out before it's too late. And this is when, you know, the quote, threat of Africans moving in was there. And we'd get calls at night that would say, they're coming. And these people then would, you know, buy houses from white people at lower prices than the homes really were worth. And that caused the down value of the homes, which is what Isabel Wilkerson was talking about, and people saw losing property value. But as soon as the racial composition of the community flipped enough so that it was more blacks, now the homes were being sold for more than they were worth, because the African Americans were desperate for property. They didn't have enough housing. As they said, they were stuffed into these communities, where, you know, just the black community. And so they would pay more, but they had to buy on contract. And I'm not sure if everybody knows about this, but buying a house on contract means that it's like a time payment. So you pay along, you know, for years maybe, but if you miss one payment, you can be evicted and have absolutely nothing to show for it, unlike if you have a mortgage and, you know, you've gotten equity into that house. So the fallout of this today, you know, as our caller kept referring to nothing new, this is the result. I mean, these are things that build up over time. Today, blacks have about 6 to 7% the wealth that whites have. And that don't mean income, I mean wealth, because most of us in this country pass our wealth on through our homes. You know, you buy a home, let's say my parents bought a home in 1950 for about, you know, $12,000. Well, you know, by 1980, that house might have been worth $80,000 or $90,000, and by the 2000s, it could have been worth $150,000. So that buildup in wealth gets passed on to the kids. So that's just a thing I wanted to mention, because this is a real effect we see today, that because blacks historically were not allowed to invest in homes, they have a lot less wealth, and that means they have less wealth to be able to send their kids to college, they have less wealth to move into a better neighborhood. So those are long, long-range impacts of a policy that was started 80 years ago.
Now, Linda, you made somewhat reference to, as did the caller, and I want to expand it a little further, to the current problems of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
The murder rate.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see a relationship between what you write about and today's murder rate?
Well, you know, I think here's what has happened. In our neighborhood, in 1968, when Martin Luther King was murdered, like hundreds of other cities in this country, our neighborhood went up in flames. And I mean, it looked like an inferno. It looked like World War II. I mean, it was just blocks and blocks of flames, reduced like a whole square and a half mile to rubble. Businesses left. The whole economic base left. So the only people who really stayed were the poorest people. It also lost an economic base. There was no place to get a job. And as the previous caller mentioned, Brian, that that when people, blacks were being incarcerated at a higher rate. So once you've been incarcerated, it's hard to get a job. So now you have this group of unemployed people, and the only economic base in these communities is, quite frankly, drugs. So, you know, you're not going to be able to support your family on $9 an hour from McDonald's. So people turn to drugs. And, of course, once you turn to drugs, you get into the whole cycle of violence and the gang mentality. Gangs are different in Chicago today from the way they used to be. You know, it used to be like there'd be one powerful person that controlled one gang and another powerful person controlled another. But now, because of social media, people can sort of like start up a gang instantly just by texting people and saying, hey, let's all meet at this corner and you know, do something bad. So the murder rate in Chicago is high. It is not as high as it's been in the past, however. People think it's, you know, over the top, but no, it's less than it actually was in the 90s. And, you know, it's Ta-Nehisi Coates made this interesting comment when people said, what do you think of black and black crime? Ta-Nehisi Coates is the writer for The Atlantic who wrote an article called The Case for Reparations. And he said, you know, this black-on-black accusations that get thrown from the white community, well, why aren't you talking about that? He said, that's like shooting somebody and then blaming them for bleeding. And what I interpret that to mean is that white institutionalized racism created these neighborhoods, right? I mean, they were created because we forced blacks into segregated neighborhoods because we would not give them any loans to be able to move into white neighborhoods. And they were attacked and beaten when they moved into white neighborhoods. So now you have these neighborhoods that are all over the country that tend to be poor, that tend not to have an economic base. People turn to drugs, and I'm not saying, hey, it's okay to be a drug dealer. That is not my point. My point is that, you know, what does white society expect when you shove African Americans into communities and then the city totally ignores those communities? We spent here in Chicago millions building a beautiful river walk. But this neighborhood that I grew up in and my father grew up in since 1914, once a vibrant neighborhood, has not come back 50 years after this riot. Mm. And I want to add also that, you know, there are good things in these neighborhoods. I mean, people help each other. I mean, it's not all bad. I've been back to my neighborhood multiple times since I left. And there are people who take care of their homes. And there are nicely, you know, cut grass. But there are many buildings that are shuttered or swaths of land that have never been rebuilt.
Okay, so, Linda, unfortunately, we're out of time.
Well, there you have it.
And I want to say thank you to Linda Gartz for an important book, Redlined, a memoir of race, change, and fractured community in 1960s Chicago.
Okay,
thank
and
you,
I want to add one more thing. If you'd like more information about redlining or my book or my family archives that I've used to write this book, go to Linda Gartz, that's GARTZ.com, and you will find a wealth of information, including book club questions and redlining histories and photos and lots of interesting stuff. So I hope you'll take a visit.
Thank you, Linda, for this book.
Thank
and a
you.
Whole lot so, more.
Thank you, Peter, for having me. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. And it's been another edition of WIP Sunday. Stay tuned for Sports Talk with Sunny Hill. Nothing left to say, but see you soon.